Some cases close with a confession, some close with a conviction, and some never really close at all. The Grimes Tapes is a detective fiction series following Detective Sarah Grimes as she works the cases that don't fit neatly into a file. Cases where power, politics, and human nature collide, and the truth is the last thing anyone wants found. Episode 6, Justice. Ellis Whitmore is arrested on a Tuesday morning. The case closes, but for Nate Brannick, what comes after the truth is harder than what came before it. This is the final episode of Next of Kin. Ellis Whitmore was arrested on a Tuesday morning at his office, which was the kind of glass and chrome space that costs more to rent monthly than Terrence Boyle made in a year. He was sitting behind his desk in his suit, and his face when the detectives walked in was not surprise, not fear, but something closer to calculation. The rapid assessment of a man who'd spent his whole career managing risk and recognized, with the precision of a financial consultant, that the portfolio had finally collapsed. Ellis Whitmore? Grimes said. I'd like to call my attorney. You can call your attorney from the precinct. Ellis Whitmore, you are under arrest for the murder of Thomas Brannick. You have the right to remain silent. She read him his rights in the measured cadence of someone who'd said these words hundreds of times and still meant every one. Callahan cuffed him. The secretary at the front desk stared. Two associates in a glass-walled conference room stopped mid-sentence and watched their boss escorted through the lobby in handcuffs, and the security guard held the door open with the particular courtesy of someone who didn't know what else to do. The case they'd built was solid, each piece supporting the next. The bathroom mirror shard from Boyle's garage, with Ellis's blood confirmed by autosomal DNA, a unique match this time, individual, unambiguous. The bellhop's corrected identification. Tom's phone records showing calls to the burner phone that, when traced through purchase records and gas station security footage, showed Ellis Whitmore buying the prepaid cell at a Sunoco station 40 minutes from his home. A text message sent from Tom's phone to Nate after the estimated time of death, at Meridian, sent not by Tom, who was already dead, but by his killer, using the phone he'd taken from the room. Tom's legal pad with Ellis's name. Claire's case file documenting the Whitmore family. The birth record for Lily Whitmore's baby. The death certificate for Lily Whitmore, age 14, cause of death, complications of childbirth. And the cell tower data. Tom's missing phone, the phone Ellis had taken from the hotel room, had continued to ping towers for 18 hours after the murder, tracing a path from the city south toward the suburbs, toward Ellis's home. The phone had eventually gone dark, powered off, destroyed, or ditched, but the trail it left was a dotted line leading directly to Ellis Whitmore's zip code, in a direction Nathan Brannick had never traveled. He took the phone to find out how much Tom knew, Grimes explained to the DA. What he'd found, who he'd talked to, whether anyone else knew the secret. He needed to know if killing Tom was enough or if the information had already spread. And had it? Tom hadn't told anyone, not Nate, not his friends. He wanted to handle it himself. He was a cop. He believed in doing things right, in order, by the book. He found the family. He reached out to Ellis. He wanted to arrange a meeting, maybe introduce Nate to his biological relatives, maybe just get medical history. He didn't know what he was walking into. And Ellis killed him because Tom's outreach threatened to expose the incest. If Tom brought Nate into the picture, DNA tests were inevitable. family reunions, medical histories, questions about who Nate's biological father was. Ellis was the father and the uncle. A DNA test would show that Nate's parents were closely related, first-degree relatives, brother and sister. Ellis's entire life, his career, his reputation, his freedom, was built on the assumption that nobody would ever know what he'd done to his 14-year-old sister. So he killed the one person who was trying to make it right. He killed the one person who didn't know it couldn't be made right. Ellis Whitmore's attorney, a partner at a firm whose hourly rate exceeded what most people earned in a day, made the expected motions. Bail was denied. The judge cited flight risk, the severity of the charges, and the defendant's alleged willingness to tamper with evidence and obstruct justice. In the holding area, Grimes stood on the other side of the glass and looked at Ellis Whitmore's face. The calculation was gone. In its place was something she'd seen before, but never quite like this. The flat blankness of a man who'd spent so long controlling the narrative that the loss of control had left him with nothing. Not remorse, not fear, not defiance, just the vacant lot where a person used to be. She didn't interview him. His attorney wouldn't allow it, and Grimes didn't need it. The evidence spoke. The DNA spoke. The mirror shard and the phone records and Claire's case file and Diane Prescott's memory and Terrence Boyle's conscience all spoke. And what they said was clear enough that a grand jury returned an indictment in less than 48 hours. First-degree murder, tampering with evidence, obstruction of justice. The charges landed with the weight of decades of concealment finally coming due. The Dunmore cops came back. Not the same way they'd come the first time, not with theories and certainty and the righteous grief of a brotherhood betrayed. This time they came quietly, carrying the heavy silence of men who'd been wrong about something important and were only beginning to understand what their wrongness had cost. Garza came to Grimes's desk, stood there for a moment without speaking. "I told your suspect about the adoption," he said. "Before I should have, before anyone confirmed it. I went to the jail and I told him."
"I know."
"You know?" "The visitor log isn't classified, Sergeant." Garza nodded. He looked tired in a way that had nothing to do with sleep.
"He didn't know," Garza said. "The kid, Nate, he had no idea about any of it. You could see it on his face. Nobody's that good an actor."
"No," Grimes agreed. "Nobody is."
"I'm sorry. For the pressure. For Melina. For all of it."
"Don't apologize to me. Apologize to the man who spent 4 weeks in a cell for a crime he didn't commit because everybody was so sure they knew the answer that nobody bothered to check the work."
Garza took that.
He took it the way good cops take hard truths, straight, without flinching, banking it for the nights when the job demanded an accounting. Melina never apologized. Some men don't. But he stopped calling, which was its own kind of admission. Callahan handled the transition with a grace that surprised Grimes, though she'd never tell him that. He briefed the Dunmore department. He walked Garza and Wheeler through the evidence. He sat with them while they processed the double revelation, that Tom had been killed not by his son, but by a man they'd never heard of, and that the son they'd wanted to bury was himself a victim of a crime that predated his first breath.
"How do you do this?" Wheeler asked Callahan after the briefing in the hallway. "How do you carry this?"
Callahan was quiet for a moment.
"You carry it," he said. "That's it. You just carry it."
Janet came back on a Tuesday afternoon, not her usual day. He'd noticed she had a usual day, Thursday, 2 o'clock, give or take, and when the guard said his attorney was here, his first thought was, something happened. She looked the same, briefcase, file, the controlled face, but she sat down and didn't open the file, and he understood he wasn't going to like this. "They made an arrest this morning," she said. He waited. "A man named Ellis Whitmore. He was taken into custody at his office. He's been charged with the murder of your father."
Ellis Whitmore. He didn't know the name. He turned it over. It didn't connect to anything he could find.
"Who is he?"
He's from Whitfield County, the same family we discussed, the biological family. Nate looked at the table. A scratch in the surface ran from the near edge most of the way across. He'd traced it before, in earlier weeks, without thinking about it. He killed Tom. The evidence against him is substantial. The charges... He killed Tom. Not a question this time. Yes. He sat with that for a moment. A man named Ellis Whitmore had been sitting in a glass and chrome office somewhere while Nate was in this room, while the charges were building, while the DNA was being explained and re-explained. A man named Ellis Whitmore had beaten Tom Brannick to death in a hotel bathtub and walked out and let someone else carry it. Why? Nate said. Janet's hands were flat on the table. He recognized what she was doing, the same thing she'd done the week before, parceling information in order. She was deciding what came next. Tom had been reaching out to the biological family, trying to find them. He made contact with Ellis Whitmore. He reached out to the person who... He didn't know. He was trying to do something good. He had no way to know what Ellis Whitmore had done. What did he do? Another pause, shorter. She'd made the decision before she walked in. The lab results from the crime scene identified DNA from someone whose parents were closely related. We talked about this last week, the secondary analysis, the homozygosity markers. He remembered. She'd said it and then moved on, and he'd filed it away in the part of his mind where the things he didn't have words for went. Closely related, he said. First-degree relatives. She was watching him. Lily Whitmore was Ellis Whitmore's sister. She was 14 when she became pregnant. He was 21. The room kept going. The fluorescent light kept buzzing. Somewhere in the building, a door closed. He heard all of it very clearly, the way you hear things when the rest of you has stopped. He was her... He didn't finish the sentence. Ellis Whitmore is your biological father, Janet said. He is also your biological uncle. Nate looked at the scratch in the table, near edge to far edge, one unbroken line. He put his finger on it. He didn't say anything. He tried to find the shape of what she'd said. Brother and sister. He knew what those words meant. He knew what they meant together, in the order she'd put them. His mind went there and then went somewhere else, the way you pull back from a stove before you've registered the heat. That's... He stopped, started again. Tom didn't... He couldn't figure out what he was trying to say. The sentence kept not arriving. Janet let the silence be what it was. She didn't fill it. She was across the table and she stayed there, and after a while, Nate became aware that he was still pressing his finger against the scratch in the table, hard enough that the fingertip had gone white. He moved his hand. Okay, he said, the same word he'd said last week, in the same flat way. Not agreement, just the only thing available. The charges are being dropped, Janet said. You'll be processed out tomorrow morning. He nodded. Nate, are you... Do you want to... I'm okay. She looked at him. She knew what okay meant in this room. She didn't argue. Tomorrow morning, she said. I'll be there. They released him on a Wednesday. The paperwork took longer than the confession, or would have if Ellis had confessed, which he hadn't, because men like Ellis Whitmore didn't confess. They lawyered up and they shut down and they let the system do its work, which was perhaps the most honest thing about them. Even their silence was strategic. Janet was there when the door opened, standing in the lobby in her coat, holding an envelope. Inside it was Claire's photograph, Claire holding him as a baby, both of them squinting into the sun, returned from the evidence inventory. She handed it to him without saying anything about it, and he held it for a moment before folding the envelope and putting it in his jacket pocket. She'd also called him a cab, and she gave him her card, which he put in the same pocket with the careful precision of someone handling the only things they owned. What happens now? He asked her in the lobby before the doors. The charges are dropped. The case against Ellis Whitmore proceeds. You may be called as a witness, but that's a long way off. I mean, what happens now? To me? Janet looked at him with those eyes that had stopped being surprised by anything, and for the first time, he saw something behind the professional competence. The recognition that some questions didn't have answers, that some damage wasn't the kind you could file a motion to repair. "That's up to you," she said. He walked out of the building into daylight that seemed louder than he remembered. The air was cold, December now, the season having changed while he wasn't looking, and it hit his face like something he hadn't braced for. Cars moved on the street, people walked on the sidewalk. A man at a food cart was selling pretzels to someone who was complaining about the price, and the sheer, indifferent ordinariness of it sat on him like weight. He had no car. He had the clothes he'd been arrested in, a month of beard, the photograph in his pocket, and Janet's card. The cab took him to his apartment. The building looked the same. The stairs smelled the same, cooking grease and laundry detergent, and the particular density of a building that housed too many people in too little space. His door was locked. His key still worked. He stepped inside and stood in the silence that had been waiting for him. The dishes in the sink, the garbage bags leaning against the door, the couch still buried under blankets and takeout containers. Everything where he'd left it, a month ago, when he was still a person who didn't know any of this. He sat on the couch. He didn't turn on the lights. Tom was dead. Claire was dead. The man who had killed Tom was a man named Ellis Whitmore, and Ellis Whitmore was also... He tried to hold the thought, and it slid. He let it slide. He took the envelope out of his pocket and opened it and looked at the photograph. Claire's eyes half shut against the sun, him against her shoulder, smaller than he'd ever imagined himself being. He didn't know what to do with it, so he set it on the cushion next to him. He didn't cry. He'd run out of that somewhere in the cell, spent it on things he'd thought were true that had turned out to be different than he knew. What he felt now was not grief and not nothing. It was something he had no name for. He was too tired to reach for one. The phone, the landline he never used, the one Claire had insisted he keep because what if the power goes out and your cell dies, rang. He looked at it. He didn't answer it. Epilogue. He went back to Dunmore one more time. Not because he wanted to. The house held nothing for him now, or held everything, which was worse. But there were things to collect, things to sign. The machinery of inheritance, which didn't know or care that the inheritance was built on a foundation of stolen identity and deathbed confessions. Tom's house was the same. The flag bracket on the porch, the mowed lawn now covered in a thin layer of frost, the porch light still off because nobody had been home to turn it on. Garza had been collecting the mail. A stack of it sat on the kitchen table, bound with a rubber band, next to Claire's laptop. Returned now, processed and cataloged, whatever it had contained extracted and documented and added to the case file, sitting on the table like something that had been opened and emptied and put back in its place. Nate stood in the kitchen where Claire had made his lunches. He stood in the living room where Tom had watched football and yelled at referees who couldn't hear him. He stood in his old bedroom, which Tom had kept exactly as it was. The posters, the bookshelf, the desk where he'd done homework and hated it, and never understood how lucky he was to hate something so ordinary. He didn't take anything. Not the photos, not the furniture, not the box of his childhood art projects that Claire had kept in the attic, labeled by year in her precise handwriting. He couldn't. Not yet. Taking things meant accepting that they were his to take, and accepting meant deciding what his meant, and that was a decision he wasn't ready to make. He drove to Claire's grave. There was a headstone now, simple granite, her name and the two dates that bracketed everything she'd been and done and carried. No inscription. Tom had died before he could choose one, and so the stone said only the bare minimum, the facts without the gloss, which was maybe more honest than anything Tom could have written anyway. Nate sat in the grass. The ground was cold through his jeans, and he didn't move away from it. December. The bare trees at the edge of the cemetery made a sound like something breathing. A crow landed on a stone three rows over, studied him for a moment with its flat, deliberate eye, and moved on. He had the photo in his hand. It had been in his jacket pocket through the whole drive down, and before that in the envelope Janet had handed him outside the jail, and before that in the evidence inventory for a month, and before that in his jacket pocket all the way back to the moment he'd taken it from Tom's house, from the box in the attic, before he'd known any of it. Claire holding him, both of them young, her young in a way he'd never seen, him young in the way you only are once. She was looking at the camera and smiling the way people smile when they don't know they're keeping a secret yet, or when they've decided the secret doesn't matter. He looked at it for a while. Then he looked at the stone. He didn't say what you'd expect. He didn't ask why or how could you or did you ever think about what this would do to me? He asked something simpler. Was I happy? The wind moved the bare trees. The crow cawed and flew away. I was happy, he said, answering himself. You made sure of that. Whatever else you did, whatever this is, I was happy. It wasn't forgiveness. It wasn't condemnation. It was something in between, something that might eventually grow into one or the other, but for now was just a fact, sitting in the cold air like breath. He stayed a while longer, not doing anything, just there with the cold coming up from the ground and the photo in his hand and the stone with its two dates and the empty space where an inscription wasn't. It was a Tuesday in December, and the cemetery was quiet except for the wind and a car going by on the road beyond the fence, and somewhere, far enough away that it might have been imagined, a dog. Then he drove back to the city. The car was quiet for the first 20 miles. This was different from the quiet that came after other hard cases, the exhausted relief of two people who'd been right about the wrong thing. This silence was heavier. It had rooms. It had floors and ceilings and load-bearing walls, and both of them were still learning the layout. Callahan drove. Grimes sat in the passenger seat with her notebook open on her lap, not writing anything, just looking at the pages. The lists, the questions, the name Ellis with a circle around it and three question marks that she'd added during week three, when everyone else had been patting themselves on the back. I almost buried him, Callahan said. He didn't say Nate. He didn't have to. You ordered the test that saved him. I ordered the test to destroy him. The outcome doesn't change the intent. Grimes considered this. Outside the window, the December landscape stripped down to its structural elements. No leaves, no color, just the bones of things, bare and honest. You want me to tell you it's okay? She said. No. Good, because it's not okay. Your worst impulse produced the best result. That's not redemption. It's dumb luck with a lab coat. Callahan's hands tightened on the wheel. So what do I do with it? Grimes looked at the road. She thought about Tom's colleagues standing in her squad room in the first week, Garza with his certainty and Molina with his, the particular confidence of men who'd loved Tom and were therefore sure they knew who'd killed him. She thought about Nate sitting in a 7x10 cell for 4 weeks while everyone was sure. She thought about Tom, who'd been sure you could make a thing right if you just drove far enough and asked the right questions. Think about what Garza's been sitting with since Wednesday, she said. Think about what he's going to sit with for the next 10 years. A man he wanted to bury turned out to be a victim, and the case he was certain about turned out to be wrong in every direction. Callahan was quiet. That's not a warning I'm giving you, Grimes said. That's just what it looks like. The highway unspooled in front of them. Different case, Callahan said. Same car, same drive home, but it's different. It's always different. No, I mean, we've had bad ones before. Cases that wore us down to nothing. This one, he searched for the word. This one changed the shape of something. Grimes looked out the window. She thought about Nate Brannick sitting in a cell. She thought about Tom Brannick curled in a bathtub. She thought about Claire Brannick, dead of cancer, carrying a secret to the grave, and then, in the final act, handing it to the one person whose decency would turn it into a death sentence. She thought about Ellis Whitmore behind his desk, calculating the cost of his sister's pregnancy for 2 decades, and concluding, again and again, that the only acceptable number was 0. She thought about Maria Gutierrez, who'd cleaned a crime scene because she was afraid of the police and missed her son's soccer game. Every case changes the shape of something, Grimes said. That's the job. You walk in one shape and you walk out another, and you do it again next week. Sounds exhausting. It is. But you keep doing it. I keep doing it, Callahan drove. Grimes closed her notebook. The city appeared in the distance, a skyline of glass and stone, and the accumulated weight of 10 million stories, most of which would never make it to a case file. Grimes? Yeah. Thank you for not being sure. She almost smiled. Almost. Don't thank me, Callahan. Just don't be sure next time either. The car pulled into the precinct lot. Callahan killed the engine. They sat for a moment in the particular silence of two people who'd been through something together, understanding still sinking in. Same time tomorrow? Callahan said. Same time tomorrow. They got out of the car. They walked into the building. They went back to work.